People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. You're listening to Fine Music Radio, and this is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note. Now, let me tell you about my guest. He's a violinist, Miklan Le Peng, whom you might have seen or even heard, who's been to South Africa a few times, both at the Stellenbosch International Chamber Music Festival and with our orchestra here. And in fact, not only is he here for this year's Stellenbosch Festival, but he's here for more concerts with the Cape Town Philharmonic. Miklan has established himself as one of the most compelling and versatile artists of his generation, a rare hybrid musician whose career moves seamlessly between the roles of soloist, chamber musician, concertmaster, educator, and curator. He was praised by the New York Times as a force to be reckoned with and hailed by Die Welt as a musician of daring virtuosity with gripping excess and noble elegance. Miklan has performed as a soloist with leading orchestras and appeared at many of the world's most prestigious venues. Listen to this: Carnegie Hall, the Musikverein in Vienna, the Walt Disney Concert Hall, the Elbphilharmonie in Hamburg, the Wigmore Hall, the Royal Albert Hall, the Berlin Philharmonie, St. Martin in the Fields, the list goes on. So, Miklan, it's good to welcome you to the studio. I hope you enjoyed that review about you.
I think the interview's done.
Shall we leave it there?
Yes, I think so. That's enough.
But now, okay, so I've just said you're back here. The Stellenbosch International Festival has just opened. And you've, in fact, done your first concert, haven't
yes,
you?
Yes, actually, the first two concerts.
Oh, the first two.
Yeah, Friday and Saturday. And that was it was really fun, really great music. Mm-hmm. We had the first concert. I was able to be a part of this incredible nonet by, well, actually, it's a nonet transcription of Laval's.
Which oh my I think goodness, Revolt's Revolt.
Exactly.
For a nonet.
So two string quartets and double bass. And I was so happy because I was when Nina Schumann asked for recommendations for pieces, that was one of mine. And I was like, yes, great.
Can you do it? I wonder what that sounds like, because it's such an orchestral showpiece.
I'm sure there's going to be a recording somewhere.
There's got to be. Yes, I hope they recorded that one that you've just done.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're here for the festival, but you were here recently, as I said, for the concert with the orchestra.
Yes. No, actually, I was here for, when was this? This is July.
Yes, it's July.
I was here for Franschhoek in February.
That's right, the Franschhoek Festival
with the orchestra. And then right before that in December, the Tchaikovsky Concerto with CPO.
That's right. Wow. And it seems to me, Miklan, that you quite like Cape Town.
I know. I think, you know, I guess I'm just trying to find a wife here.
Really? Are you?
No. No.
Nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that.
No. I mean, I would be here more if I did. But okay. No. But I love it here. I mean, like being here in Cape Town in any season. Like there have been such beautiful days, especially now in the winter. You don't get that in Europe. Everything's gray in the winter or rainy, and there's not really any like blue days. But here, it's just perfect all the time.
So. And also, perhaps a good thing is you're away from the Europe heat at the moment.
Yes, exactly.
That huge heat wave sweeping across Europe.
It's right now. It's crazy. In Paris, it was just 42 degrees.
It seems unbelievable that it's 42 degrees. I have a friend who lives in Berlin, and I was talking to him when his thermometer said 41.
Yeah.
And that was at 11:15 in the morning.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's extraordinary. But now, with South Africa, like this Chamber Music Festival, you've been before, haven't you, to the Chamber Music Festival?
Not for the Stellenbosch one. Actually, this is the first time I've been here.
For
the Stellenbosch Chamber Music Festival. Mm-hmm. And it's really nice because it's so different than the Franschhoek one. Because the Franschhoek one is, it's for the orchestra musicians. It's for the musicians to play chamber music together. And then they have one or two international artists come in, which I've had the privilege to do. But the Stellenbosch Chamber Music one, it's, you know, you have 200, 300 students, and then you have countless numbers of international faculty flying in from all over the world, and it just becomes a big party.
I'm sure it does, actually. But, I never thought of that.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's interesting because, you know, you're not the only international there, and I'm not the only international here this time, and it's so nice to be collaborating with old friends and new friends. And mm-hmm. yeah.
And the other thing about this Stellenbosch Festival is the works are very interesting. They're the standard, well-known chamber works.
Exactly.
But they're works that are commissioned, they're new works.
Yes.
It's quite an intense chamber music week or two, isn't
it? I think they have over 10 South African premieres.
In this one festival?
In this one festival.
Wow,
yeah.
That is...
And it's you know, you have a piece by Owen Dalton, you have pieces by Anton Gergen, you have pieces just all over the place. But, you know, you have your standards. Like, for example, you have your Franck piano quintet, you have your Sorcerer's Apprentice, which was there on opening night, you have Arensky's piano quintet, you know, pieces like this. But it's nice because I think they do a really good job in programming and bringing audiences to these new contemporary works.
It is. That's an ideal place to
yes,
do it as well.
Exactly.
But then they don't forget about the full symphonic works, do they? Because they're ending with Mahler's First Symphony.
That's true. And also a concerto that I'm playing at the end, which is the Mendelssohn Violin and Piano Concerto
with yes.
Emmanuel Ivanov.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so that's the final concert. That's
they're keeping you at the beginning.
They're keeping me all the way through.
But you are coming back to the orchestra here yes. later this month or next or soon.
No, so I'm coming back in February next year.
Oh, is it next year? Right.
And then I'm coming back again in April for two season concerts.
With the Cape Philharmonic.
With the Cape Philharmonic.
And also I see that you are a passionate chamber musician, so an opportunity to go to a place like a Stellenbosch Chamber Music Festival must be right up your street.
It's incredible. Yeah, I'm having such a good time. And there's so many great chamber musicians here, or people, even not even the international ones, but the people from the orchestra, people from all around the country coming in to just want to play chamber music. And I mm-hmm. think that's the most intimate way and most beautiful way to play music.
Oh, good for you. So now, I'm most intrigued what music you've chosen for us to share with us, Micklin. And what is your first piece? A great pianist coming up, I see.
Yes, I mean, I've been to about four Sokolov concerts in person, and I just went to one, when was this? Maybe it was like 2 months ago in the Berlin Philharmonic, and it was absolutely incredible. But there was one, I think it was like 3 times ago, and he was playing this impromptu, this from his A flat impromptu. I think it's like D935.
That's Schubert.
Schubert, exactly. Yeah. And it's one that even when I get on the piano, I just start playing. But the way that he plays this, and this is a special Esterházy Palace recording on Deutsche Grammophon, that there's something that he does with rubato and breath that I think no one else does. And that's why I love just listening to his recordings.
Schubert's Impromptu, the A-flat Impromptu, played there by Grigory Sokolov. And thank you, my guest, incidentally, the violinist Miklan Lepang, chose that and told us to listen out for that rubato and that sort of breathing.
Yes.
Because I remember reading something, and I think it had to do with Furtwängler, that it's all very well taking rubato, but you've got to pay back all the time.
Exactly.
You can't just take rubato and pull the whole thing out.
And that's how I love, honestly, that's whenever I teach or whenever I also play music, I always try to treat phrases like columns. And so if I'm going to run faster toward another column, I need to always slow down. It's like a give and take.
Mm-hmm.
So anytime that you take a lot of time, you have to make sure you give back the same amount of time mathematically in order for the phrase to make sense. And I find that with certain people like Sokolov, that it feels like a breath. Like you always have a climax in the phrase, and then you know you have this exhale of energy. And I find rubato to be so... at least the practice of rubato to be so important in a way that we should be copying human breath or singers. Because as instrumentalists, we have keys, we have a bow and strings, and so we can hold the note forever. But with singers, there's always this kind of... you can always breathe with singers, you know?
Yes.
With string players and pianists, sometimes you can't breathe because you always feel like a bit tense up. But I always just try to copy the human breath when it comes to rubato. So that's
beautifully put, because as I say, and it's a complicated mechanism, for want of a better word, rubato, because it's got to be used properly.
Exactly.
And while that was playing, you said that Sokolov seldom plays a concerto. He prefers being alone.
He doesn't play any concertos. He only plays by himself. He lives in a small town in Italy, and he goes and does just concerts. And he travels between concerts by train or by car. By road, he doesn't fly.
Oh, really?
And so he only does these. So he's never done a concert tour in the U.S. I don't think so. And if he has, it's been a long time ago, and he probably went by ferry, by cruise ship, or whatnot. But he has this incredible demeanor. As I said, I've been to a lot of his concerts, and it always is so remarkable the presence that he has on stage and how he captures the audience.
That is interesting.
I'm so happy to be alive in the same time that he's performing.
What a lovely thing to say. And you let something slip just now. Do you also play the piano?
A little bit. Yeah. My mom's a piano teacher. And so...
oh, so you picked it up on the way? Or?
Yeah, on the way. So I started violin first and then piano at age... so violin at age 3 and violin at age 3, piano at age 5.
And your piano playing, we know that you're a superb violinist because you've had so
I
much proof. And the piano playing, or is that just something personal, or do you perform ever?
No, I don't perform. It's more just for myself. I can improvise a little bit on the piano. I can play a bit of Schubert. I can play a little bit of Brahms, but
the violin is the main thing. And right at this point, I want you to tell me about your violin. Because it's quite special, I've read somewhere.
It's a 1707 Antonio Stradivarius, made in his golden period. And it was owned by my old violin professor, Charles Castleman, who gifted the violin to the Queen Elizabeth Music Chapelle because he had great memories of being in the Queen Elizabeth Music Competition. And so because of that, he's donated to the Chapelle, which... there's a web of information here, which has gifted me the violin to use until I think the end of next year or in 2 years.
So when they do gift you something like that, it's not forever.
No.
It's always for a period of time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But then aren't you going to be heartbroken when you give it back?
You know, like I'm enjoying it while it's here, while I'm able to play it. And I think playing a Strad, it's like... having a toxic girlfriend.
Here we go with the girlfriend.
No. It's you know, Strads are known to be really temperamental.
Mm-hmm.
It teaches you to be a better musician because it doesn't do exactly what you want it to do. You need to do what it wants to do. And with Strads, it's been really wonderful to play on the Strad for the last 3 years and for the next 2 years. But But it's taught me a lot about my playing, but I think I'm ready to just let go and use an instrument that will just allow me to just be myself.
Have you got an instrument like that?
Yeah.
Apart from the Strat?
Yes, I do.
Your own?
Yes, and it's a French violin by a famous French maker, Jean-Baptiste Vuillaume. And it was made in 1850, and it used to be the violin of Arthur Grumio.
Oh.
And it's an incredible instrument, and it's, yeah.
I wow. love it. Yeah. Have you any idea what that Strat is worth?
Yes.
Are you going to tell us?
it's a lot. It's a lot. It's a few homes. Yeah.
A few homes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you look after it, I hope.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very carefully.
Yeah. It never leaves my side.
And with your Strat, do you use it in all repertoire? Do you use it in chamber music, in romantic repertoire? Yeah. Would you use it in the big romantic violin concertos? Mm. Or how do you decide when to use that or another one?
That's a really great question, because I use the Strat when there is something super sentimental, when there's something that needs a lot of color, when there's a microphone that's right on the violin, because there's something about this violin that sings, and there's something inside that vibrates and resonates in incredibly beautifully. For example, the Vuillaume, I feel, allows me to do that same thing with a little bit more work, but projects to the end of the hall better than the Strat does.
Oh, really? Yeah. That's interesting.
So, because the Strat 1707, it has a high arching. It has high arching, so it kind of has this bump, like a camel hump, above the two F holes. And because of that, it doesn't project that much. Later, 1708, 1709, the camel hump, the arching flattens, and that's when the sound is really loud. And so it's, unfortunately, it's not like a little bit later.
Okay.
But for example, the CD that I just released was recorded on the Strat because it was a recording and because I knew I didn't have to worry about projection.
Right. That makes absolute sense. Yeah. And we've got that recording, and I think we're going to play a track from it later on.
Yeah.
So there you are. Now, let's take another piece of your music. And the Danish String Quartet here, what are we about to hear?
So this is such a fun piece. I love playing this. I run a few music festivals, and I always have this as an encore in the festivals. And it's a folk tune. It's this old Rhinelander from Sondela. It's a folk tune that just makes you want to get up and dance. And it's such a vibe. And I'm excited to share this with all of you. Thank you.
How about that? That was called Old Rhinelander from Sonnedala, a traditional Dutch string quartet work, and it was chosen by my guest, the violinist Mecklen Le Pang, who's here with me in the studio this week. And just now you called that your party piece.
Yeah, I love this piece so much.
So yeah. Thank you for sharing it with us. No, you know, we were talking about your violin, your Strad, and the other one that you've got, but one thing I often forget to ask a violinist is about the bow.
Yeah.
Because for example, let's talk about the Strad. Does it have its own bow, or what sort of bow do you have?
Yeah, no, I have my own bows that I use with the instruments. And I really feel that at points, the bow is more important than the instrument itself. Because the bow is what you use in order to produce articulation,
yes,
and to produce, like, actually produce the sound.
Right.
And the reaction of everything is half got to do with the bow. And the bow is an incredible tool, but the bow that I have, that I use all the time, is my favorite piece of wood.
That's one way of putting it.
A piece of stick that I've ever tried. And it's a Picat. It's a Dominique Picat. And it was once owned by the violinist Eugène Izay.
Oh, yes.
And so that's his
because
old
home. Because I think not many people may realize that things like the pressure, you were talking about pressure just now, on the strings, which you apply with the bow, and also the speed with which you pull the bow across the strings. It's very important, isn't
it?
And the length of bow you use. Mm-hmm. I've often heard conductors in rehearsals saying to them, you've got all that space, why are you using only 6 inches of your bow?
Exactly, yes.
So the bow is a very, very integral
part,
obviously.
It is, yeah. And I think it's easy to kind of switch instruments if you have your own bow.
Oh.
Then you feel at home, at least with the reaction, with the, and I really do believe sound is produced by the bow,
right?
You know, but,
and to some extent the player.
Exactly. Yes.
Mecklen, I just want to go back now a little bit into your past.
Yeah,
you were born in California, right? And your home, you say now, is in Paris.
Yes.
And you do lots of traveling, because I mentioned all those concert halls and all the things you've done and orchestras you've played with.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I want to know how it all started. You said you started the violin at 3, and you come from a musical family because you said your mother's a teacher.
Yeah, I started the violin at the age of 3. And the reason I started was because my brother's a violinist, and he's 20 years older than me. And
so 20 years?
Yeah, so he just turned 51, I think.
Okay.
And so
you've just given away your age.
I know.
Never mind.
I'm giving up on it.
Not yet. We've got too many things to talk about.
But he was studying. I mean, he was in college by the time I was born.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to be like him. I wanted to be, like my brother. And so I decided I wanted a violin. And I kept saying, I want a violin. And my parents gave me a violin. And that's the rest is history.
3 is that's very young, but of course the violin needs to start early, doesn't it?
I think so. I mean, there's something about having to internalize the music. It's something about having it be a part of your air, having it be your second language already, or first language. I think I couldn't even read at the time.
I'm sure not at 3. Yes.
Yeah.
But could you read music at very early age?
I could. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So when I started, what was great about my first teacher was that she first focused on teaching me how to read music. And so that was great because it was both reading music and doing it by ear.
Mm-hmm.
So it was both went really hand in hand.
Right. And the other thing I wanted to ask you, and this has to do with all the traveling you do, I've known a few violinists who have problems with their left shoulder because of that unnatural situation you stand and sit in. So you must need to keep yourself fit at the same time.
Yeah.
Physically fit.
Yeah. I mean, I do a lot. I really believe in prevention before.
Prevention is better than cure.
Exactly.
I think that's how it goes.
Yeah. So I do a lot of physical exercise. So I always try to, wherever I go, I always try to go to a gym.
Mm-hmm.
I always try to have, if I don't have a gym, I always have like a 15 to 20 minute just stretch/strengthening regimen with resistance bands in my hotel room. But if I have the chance, I would go to a gym. I would go to do a Pilates course in whatever city that I'm at. I love to rock climb whenever there's a chance. So I just try to keep fit and my body to be in healthy shape, because I treat music and violin playing like a sport, because we're playing for like 6, 7, 8 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we need to make sure that we have the tool, the capacity to give our best ability for that whole time. And for me, like, it's really important to just eat well, to get enough sleep, and to keep physically fit. And mentally.
Yeah, and I was going to say mentally as well, yes. Because that's very important.
Yes.
And the physical will help the mental,
yes,
won't it?
Yes, exactly. They both goes hand in hand.
Talking about rock climbing, here's a silly question. Have you climbed Table Mountain?
Yeah, I actually did two Table Mountain climbs in the past week.
Oh, okay.
I did one. It was with Marietta, who's one of the concertmasters of the CPO, and with Simon, who is the principal bassoonist of the CPO.
Okay.
We did one hike last week, and it was right face arrow traverse, and it was it was a life or death situation. It was really fun. I enjoyed it, but we were like hanging off the rock, and it was great. And then we did Indian Fence later in the week. So yeah, so I've done, I think, Table Mountain now. I think it's been 5 times. Yeah.
And still love it and find it a challenge.
I will do it again the next time I'm here.
Really? I mean, the other thing I must tell listeners was that you were talking about last week, you played for us at our birthday concert.
Exactly.
That lunch hour concert we did, which was very kind of you to do that.
No, thank you for having me. Yeah.
And to celebrate our birthday. So that's something special, you can say.
Yep.
And you need to – we talk about physical fitness and rock climbing.
Yeah.
But you need to be very careful of your fingers.
Exactly. But I also think – you know, it's like anything else. If you were to do it once a month or once every 2 months, then you will get injured because your body's not used to it. Mm-hmm. But I try to do physical exercise every other day, at least, or every day. And especially with rock climbing, if I'm going to do it, I need to make sure that there are days on the week following that I'll be doing it as well, if that makes sense.
Yes,
so that my body isn't... doesn't go into shock. It's like, what are you doing? Why is it suddenly? Because that's where injury comes in, when your body doesn't know, or it's something foreign happening to your body. And so for me, that's why I just try to keep moving. And
goodness me, you have a busy life. Not only are you playing climbing Table Mountain, and goodness knows what else you get up to. However, let's have another piece of music now. Yes, something perhaps unexpected from you. Earth, Wind, and Fire, and their piece called September.
Exactly. I love Earth, Wind, and Fire. And also, September is my birth month. So, you know, I used to listen to this all the time. I love listening to Earth, Wind, and Fire, the Bee Gees, while driving. And it's just such a fun song.
Chasing the clouds.
Sometimes one never knows what one's going to hear next on this program. We break rules, FMR's rules. That was the group Earth, Wind & Fire in their song called September. And it was a choice of my guest this week on People of Note, brought to you by Peter Turin Productions, Mictlan Lai Pang, a violinist who is here for, among other things, the Stellenbosch International Music Festival. And we've seen quite a lot of him, and he's seen quite a lot of us by the sounds of things. Have you been to the wine farms and so on?
When I was in Franschhoek, we went to a couple.
Of course.
Yeah, and yes, Stellenbosch, actually not yet. Not yet, but I'm looking. I was in Old Nectar last week.
Okay.
And that was really nice, but I mean, no, not. I hopefully this upcoming week when I'm here.
Yes. Yeah. Then where do you go after this, by the way?
I go back to Paris for 12 hours. And then and then I go to Belgium for a trio tour. My trio is giving a tour.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going through Belgium and then France.
You know, earlier on when I was telling everyone how wonderful you are, I've said here that you've been a concert master as well, and you also said, is that something you enjoy doing? Being a concert master?
I love doing concert master work. I usually come in to orchestras and I do guest concert master work. I had a job. My first job was actually a concert master job. I was 20 and I won it. It was the Florida Opera, and I got concert master for 3 years. And I loved leading an orchestra. I loved playing opera. I loved that sounds horrible. I loved being in charge.
Nothing wrong with saying that.
But I go around a lot to different places. Like I go to Spain and I play concertmaster for the orchestras there, in Germany, whenever they need guest concertmasters. Because it's fun to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's yeah.
And I mean, the concert master sometimes, depending on the repertoire, has to do some really quite virtuosic things.
Exactly.
If you think, the old one that comes to mind is Scheherazade,
exactly.
Remarkable part for this concert master.
Yep. And Strauss, Einheldenleben.
Yes,
as well.
Einheldenleben.
Don Juan has some as well. You know, all these ones. And it's some wicked solos. But it's nice because you're surrounded by so many people.
We are, and you're in charge.
Exactly.
As you just said. And the orchestral repertoire for strings, just generally, let alone solo pieces, can be quite virtuosic, can't it? Just normally.
Like
even a Beethoven symphony.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Like a Beethoven symphony, even like a Mendelssohn symphony.
Yes, Mendelssohn,
like a Mendelssohn Italian, Mendelssohn Scottish. Yeah, it can be really virtuosic, especially like there's pieces even, and since I'm a chamber musician at heart, there are pieces that cross over into like string orchestra work as well. For example, like Transfigured Night by Schoenberg.
Yes,
that can be done in both a sextet setting and in an orchestra setting. And also Death of the Maiden and all these by Schubert and a lot more others.
Mm-hmm. So. Goodness me, what a life you have, Mictlan, and you thoroughly enjoy it. I read somewhere that you were 11 when you founded your first youth orchestra.
Well, that's true. I forgot about that.
Talking about being in charge.
I forgot about that. Yeah.
You really did in your hometown.
I did. It was a little youth orchestra, and I think it was called IPS. And it was actually my first nonprofit that I created as well.
Mm-hmm.
With my parents' help, obviously. I didn't know what a freaking nonprofit was when I was 11.
No, of course not.
the for-profit was being with all my friends that were in the orchestra. So.
Yes, for the party part.
Exactly.
Which clearly it's important for you.
Exactly. I created this orchestra after going to a festival when I was 10. And it was just a lot of people together. And, you know, when you're 10, you have a lot of friends coming together to play in an orchestra. And then when I came home, you know, my parents are very Christian. So we went to church, and then I saw a lot of people playing instruments. And then I was like, wait, we should create a little orchestra at church. So then we created this orchestra that lasted for about 6 years.
Oh, as long as that.
Yeah,
so, and did it work?
Yeah,
did
we went on tour for like through California. We went to Disneyland and performed at Disneyland. It was great. It was a great time.
It just reminded me that I said you'd performed in the Disney Concert Hall, the Walt Disney Concert Hall, which looks incredible architecturally.
Yeah.
Is it a joy to play in that?
Yeah, it's incredible. You feel so alone and hugged at the same time, because it's this kind of architecture, and it's a lot now in a lot of these halls,
mm-hmm.
Like the Paris Philharmonie or the Elbe Philharmonie, where it's like this, you know, you're surrounded by so many people.
Yes.
But it's kind of in this circular pattern so that you feel as though like you're hugged, but at the same time seen.
And do you like that, this sort of surround audience?
I do, because I do like the feeling of intimacy when playing the instrument.
Mm-hmm.
I like being on stage, but at the same time, it's a bit comforting to know that you have everyone on either side of you just
yes.
kind of like...
Even in the very big halls, like I was lucky enough to go to the Elbe Philharmonie.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's a huge hall,
huge.
An architectural phenomenon,
yeah.
masterpiece, I
yeah.
think, perched
yeah.
on top of that warehouse. But also by contrast, then, the Berlin Philharmonie,
yeah.
where you're sort of in the center of the concert hall,
yes.
but the audience is mostly in front of you.
Exactly. And then there's only like a few rows behind or a few. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're all interesting.
Okay.
I think different music reacts differently to each hall.
And when you go to a hall for the first time, do you think, I wonder what this is going to sound like, and you start playing and you either go wow or oh dear,
yeah.
or is it mostly wow, this is great?
You know, that's a really difficult question.
Okay.
No, but I think usually the halls that are built now are, as you said, like they're architectural marvels. They're beautiful. They're magnificent. Do most of them sound good? Yes. Do some sound bad? Yes.
Yeah, okay.
So it's always a mixed bag.
Listen, we need another piece of music. My
yes.
Foolish Heart, Tony Bennett
yes.
and Bill Evans now.
I love jazz. That's my guilty pleasure. I actually hardly listen to classical music. Only when I'm studying a piece.
What a terrible confession.
But I love...
What are we going to do with you?
I love listening to Bill Evans, and I love Tony Bennett's voice, and this song, it's the perfect... Especially since it's winter. I listen to this in the winter when the fireplace is on, when there's candles crackling, when you feel just the warmth and the smell of cinnamon. And this is my one of my favorite pieces, My Foolish Heart.
The scene is set for dreaming. Love's knocking at the door. But oh my heart, I'm reluctant to start, for we've been fooled before. The night is like a lovely tune. Beware, my foolish heart. How white the ever constant moon. Take care, my foolish heart. There's a line between love and fascination that's hard to see on an evening such as this. For they both give the very same sensation when you're lost in the magic of a kiss. Her lips are much too close to mine. Beware, my foolish heart. But should our eager lips combine, then let the fire start. For this time it isn't fascination or a dream that will fade and fall apart. It's love. This time it's love, my foolish. his heart. This time it isn't fascination or a dream that will fade and fall apart. It's love. This time it's love, my foolish heart.
There's some jazz for you from my classical violinist, Mick Glenn LePage, who's here. And that's Bill Evans and Tony Bennett, My Foolish Heart, with your cinnamon and fire and all that in winter. One of the other things, just because time, of course, is always an issue, I gather that you are very interested and committed to outreach and education.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does that just come naturally to you, that you have this urge to educate and help people and teach people?
I think so. My mom, my parents are, I really feel as though my parents are some of the kindest and most generous people that I know. And
are they still alive?
Yeah, they're still alive. My dad just turned 79.
Oh, right.
And my mom just turned 75. And so I call them every day. They're like my closest people.
Are they still in California?
They're still in California, yeah. And they love to go, when I was younger, they loved to go out to senior homes and to hospitals to play. And that's how I would play and run through pieces. And then I would talk to the patients. And you know, my mom was also a choir director. And so it's just all these outreach things that she would do. I think it became somewhat embedded in me. And so I decided that I wanted to give back to people at a very young age. And I love doing it there's no prestige, there's nothing, but I love seeing the reaction or the effect that music has on people that would not have access to it in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, seeing in, like, for example, in the Philippines, seeing a child hold a violin for the first time and pull that bow on the string, seeing that face light up in those eyes, something you can't get from playing in the Elbphilharmonie, or that you can't do at the Berlin Phil.
Yeah.
Seeing a child hold a cello in between their legs in Venezuela and then pulling the bow and then feeling their whole body vibrate. That's a different, you don't see that. And that I would take over performing at the Concertgebouw any day or at the Musikverein, just because music should be something that should be accessible to everyone and everyone should have access to it. And I think that unfortunately a lot of, since I live in Europe, I'm going to use it as an example, but a lot of European standards of classical music are somewhat elitist. when it comes to, you know, who has access to it.
Yes, that is true. That's one of the big problems.
Exactly. And so, you know, that I love to bring music into the community and help as many kids as possible.
Do you do master classes at all?
I do, yeah.
With trained musicians?
Yeah, I do.
Opposed to the less privileged?
Yes, yeah. No, I mean, that's, yes, outreach is a huge part of what I do or what I would like to do. But I mean, yes, the truth is the majority of it is all like the...
Like full professional
exactly.
stuff.
Exactly, yeah.
And do you enjoy master classes? Because they're certainly fun to watch, by the way. I always think as a person in the audience, you learn so much about music in a master class.
Yeah, I love giving master classes. I've had... over 8 teachers now. And I think each one comes from such different backgrounds. And I always try, whenever seeing a student, to change the way that I teach or to change the way that I speak, just depending on what they're reactive to. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's really important. I think it's nice to give master classes. I think it's a lot of fun.
Your life is a lot of fun. We're going to have to end now, but you're not going to get away without playing us a track from your new CD. Tell us a little bit about it.
So actually, Rodney, that was great. 2 days ago, I got notice from my label saying that my album is going to be, they're going to nominate my album for a Grammy.
Oh, my. So, congratulations.
Thank you. So what you're going to hear now is actually a track from the CD Deep River, and it's an album that is... it's called Deep River first because the first piece in the album is called Deep River, but also I think of it as a metaphor for my life with picking up different influences from everywhere that I've lived. So Deep River, so it starts from when I was born. I started the violin, I started playing Deep River with my mom, and then Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen, then there's an Adoration by Borofsky, and then it goes on to my life in the East Coast, and then in Europe, goes through Kreisler, goes through Eugene Onegin, Tchaikovsky, goes through Schumann. And then it ends up in France, where the last two tracks, well, the last four tracks, the last is the Ravel Violin Sonata, because I live in Paris. And then the last track is a concert fantasy on themes on Porgy and Bess by George Gershwin. And for me, that's really cool because George Gershwin spent a lot of time in Paris, and studying with Boulanger and everything, but they told him, you know, you need to do what you do best, which is writing American like style music, which is Porgy and Bess, and it's like an American in Paris, which
situation.
Exactly,
you are an American in Paris.
Yeah.
A lovely reason to play this concert fantasy from your new CD. Micklin, will end with that, but thank you so much for being a delightful guest, and looking forward to seeing you back next year, February.
Yes.
I think you said back with us here and climb another mountain.
thank you, Rod.
Look after yourself in the meantime.
Thank you,
and your Strad and your fingers.
Thank you. I will.
My guest was Micklin Lepang.
Thank you.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.